You ever watch the news and think, whoa, this seems...
Unprecedented?
Unprecedented?
It's unprecedented.
This has never happened before. This is unprecedented.
Well, that's not always quite true. I'm Matt Bevan, and my show, if you're listening, is about finding times that what's happening now has happened before and figuring out what we can learn from it. Learning from history. I mean, who could imagine? Find new episodes on ABC Listen every Thursday.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We've been keeping a secret. This was the second trial of Rajwinder Singh, and in this episode, we're going to compare this one with the one held earlier in 2025. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to the case of Toya's murder.
The body of Toya Cordingley was found at Wongeti Beach, north of Cairns.
Her face adorns billboards and stickers across the region.
Searching for clues in the murder of the 24-year-old pharmacy worker.
Alongside the idyllic and isolated beaches.
The jury returned to say that they all agreed that Rajwinder Singh was guilty.
Throughout the trial of Rajwinder Singh, we got so many emails about whether or not we knew this was a retrial. Yes, we did, but we couldn't talk about it. So in this episode, I've got ABC Far North reporter Chris Tester back in the studio to talk through the kind of key differences between Trial 2, which you've just been through, and Trial 1, which was earlier this year. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Stocky.
All throughout this trial, as we're making the pod, we'd have these conversations during the day about kind of what was different between the way the evidence was being presented to the trial that you sat through earlier this year. I mean, just quickly, what are a couple of the key things that really stood out to you?
I think mostly just the way evidence was presented. There was a lot of detail in the first trial. There was somehow even more detail in the second. And I think we saw some shifts in strategy, both from the Crown and how they presented this kind of narrative of Rajwinder Singh killing Toya Cordingley and then fleeing the country, but also the way the defence kind of characterised Rajwinder Singh as a person as well.
Yeah, and in this episode, we're going to talk through all those details. Some of the little things I find fascinating, like the tactics that have changed throughout and the way that that information was presented. We've also got so many questions from you that have been sent through to the Case Of inbox, thecaseof@abc.net.au. So be dropping in them as well and have a few of my own, of course. Chris, to get us going, though, when was the first trial of Rajwinder Singh for the murder of Toya Cordingley?
Yeah, it ran earlier this year. It started at the end of February. And ran through till mid-March when, after probably a similar amount of time, 3 to 4 weeks of evidence and then 3 days of deliberations, it ended in a hung jury.
I mean, a hung jury must have been quite a dramatic result of that time, right?
It was, and I was actually just looking at the pictures, the news photographs that we took that day, and you know, it was a rainy day in Cairns, and you can just see the look on the faces of loved ones of Toya as they're walking out of court, and kind of this numb look, certainly no sense of closure, and I guess the realization for everybody who had to give evidence that they were going to have to do it all over again.
Yeah, I mean, we were really keen to talk about this being a retrial. It was something that I found really interesting, and I was looking forward to kind of seeing what differences there were in how they were presented. But we weren't able to talk about it until the end of the trial. I mean, there was no specific non-publication order over the fact it was a retrial, but we kind of made the decision to leave it out and not get into it until the trial had finished. Chris, why was that? What was the kind of thinking there?
Well, the golden rule when you're covering a trial at court is don't report anything that's said in the absence of the jury. And while it may seem like the worst kept secret in Cairns and that everyone in Far North Queensland would have known there was a trial earlier this year, the simple fact is until the 12 jurors and the three reserves heard that, it's a fact that isn't part of the evidence of the case, and there's a risk that it could be prejudicial, in this case, both to the Crown and to the defence. So it's something that you have to leave out. Had it come up during the trial, and it did in very, 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 I guess, kind of a roundabout way where there was mention of, quote, a previous trial, that was what we could say. But The jury was never explicitly told during the evidence that there was a trial earlier this year. It was a criminal trial and what the outcome of that trial was.
Mm, yeah. Chris, I mean, the trials started much the same. There were a few kind of order differences, but really the kind of the key difference that we've spoken about was the way that Toya Cordingley's boyfriend, Marco Heidenreich, was kind of, I guess, framed throughout the defence cross-examination and throughout their entire case, really. Talk me through kind of how this was set up, because he was sort of, from my understanding, kind of posited as a kind of potential murderer of Toya Cordingley in that first trial.
That's right, and he was in the second as well, but I think there was slightly less emphasis on Marco Heidenreich, emphasis on slightly. He was still questioned and he was still cross-examined. Angus Edwards, who represented Rajwinder Singh at the first trial, really ran a defence that focused on three people, which we heard evidence from during the second trial as well. So Marco Heidenreich, Evan McRae, the nudist tradesman who had that history of violence that we heard about in court, and Remy Fry, the school teacher who was visiting his mum at Wongeti Beach. And Angus Edwards really zeroed in on the police investigation. He described it in his addresses to the jury in that first trial as having been flawed from the start. There was a lot of cross-examination about the way detectives questioned Marco Heidenreich in terms of them having known his stepfather, Andrew Lurs, who was the former Cairns police sergeant. And he really set that framing of the case, which to a degree I think still... It's evident when you look at the way this case is discussed, for example, in online circles to this day. Angus Edwards' kind of framing really set in the way people are looking at this. And the fact that Marco Heidenreich was among the first witnesses, and we heard that evidence about Toya meeting Tyson Franklin, that cross-examination was long and it was quite pointed and quite direct. Mm-hmm. It really set up a different flavour of the first trial and, you know, probably put the prosecution on the back foot a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about Tyson Franklin there. He's the podiatrist that Toya Cordingley had sent a heap of messages to in the weeks prior to her murder, and there was this kind of budding romance there. I mean, Chris, when you're saying he was, you know, Marco Heidenreich's question about that, was that basically kind of like this an interrogation of, you know, where his relationship with Toya Cordingley was at and if he'd had, you know, any kind of motive for murdering her?
Yeah, you'll recall in the second trial, Greg Maguire KC asking Marco Heidenreich about, you know, how could he have missed that 317 text that Toya sent telling him that she was to pick up Tyson that night? There were a few questions around that and it kind of ended there, whereas in the first trial there was a lot more questioning about, you know, could he have found out about Tyson in some way, look through her computer, her phone? It was the same line of questioning. It just went on for a lot longer and was clearly a very heavy focus of the defence case.
Yeah. And I mean, you're talking before about the kind of the perception that this angle, I guess, had on the community in Cairns. So, you know, we heard at the end of the most recent trial that, you know, Marco Heidenreich had kind of been described as almost a victim in this scenario as well. I mean, is that because, you know, I guess the defence angle in the first case was so successful that it kind of, you know, kind of gave people the impression that this guy was a likely murderer?
The Crown Prosecutor Nathan Crane pointed to the first trial, but also the second, in making those submissions in sentencing to Justice Crowley, that Marco Heidenreich had effectively been accused of murder, despite the fact that he said the evidence to support that wasn't just weak, it was non-existent.
Mm.
And interestingly, this was a submission that Justice Crowley accepted in sentencing Rajwinder Singh. He really took aim at him for, you know, essentially throwing all these other people under the bus and trying to deflect blame onto others while not taking any responsibility or showing any remorse himself.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, you know, you talked a little bit about Remy Fry and Evan McRae. I mean, in the second trial, we saw their kind of like their past dragged up, you know, the history that they had, you know, with Evan McRae around violence. I mean, was that something that was kind of turned up to 11 in the first trial?
To be honest, I actually think Greg Maguire, he asked Evan McRae about some things that Angus Edwards didn't. For example, we asked about him having stolen some nappies from a supermarket about 11 years ago, which I think fit in with the different flavour of Greg Maguire's defence of the Rajwinder Singh defence in the second trial was really heavily focused on this idea that violent men with knives, men with, you know, potentially drug problems or mental health problems are at Wangetti Beach, and they know these bush tracks. They go pig hunting. And I think, you know, we heard evidence that Evan McRae had at some point gone pig hunting, may have gone pig hunting at Wangetti Beach. So there was a real focus on that in the second trial. The defence case was really heavily focused on this kind of wide net of men with potential violent tendencies to have been in the area. It's, again, it was something that Angus Edwards kind of alluded to in his closing address at the first trial, but they essentially made the same cases, but shifted the emphasis in the second trial to slightly less away from Marco Hardenreich and more towards this kind of wide net of people.
Mm, yeah. And I mean, as well as kind of those three men, someone who played a different role in the first trial was Tyson Franklin. Now, he appeared earlier in the trial, the first trial, the one in March 2025. And in the most recent trial, he appeared right at the end. And I mean, I want to get to a question that we've been sent here from Claire, actually, to the case of at abc.net.au. Claire writes, "Hi, I was just looking up Tyson Franklin. I live in Cairns and I think I went to him when he was a podiatrist and came across an article that mentions he was charged with very serious offences in 2019. Did he have an alibi for the day that Toya was murdered? I know he was meant to be on a plane, but was he?"
Yeah, I mean, he had one of the strongest alibis in the whole trial in that he was physically not in Cairns. We saw evidence. We saw CCTV footage from the airports. We saw his Uber receipt. He actually did arrive in Cairns from Sydney around the time that Toya was meant to pick him up, and obviously she wasn't there at the airport to collect him that evening, so he caught an Uber home. I guess, again, he was an earlier witness in the first trial, and the questioning in the first trial of Tyson Franklin went further than it did in the second, because in the second trial he was asked about, you know, the nature of his relationship with Toya. We saw some of those many of the hundreds of messages that they exchanged in those few weeks that they were getting to know one another. But in the first trial, the defence grilled Tyson Franklin on his online behaviour.
Yeah, and I think this is where Claire's getting in her email, because Tyson Franklin was charged and found guilty of possessing child exploitation material in 2018. And so was that something that was kind of pulled apart in the trial, and was that discussed?
Well, you'll remember that the Crown cases, that police, straight after Toya's murder, investigated a lot of people. Of course, they realised that on the night she was meant to be picking up Tyson Franklin, they actually went to find him. We heard this in court. They went to find Tyson Franklin that night. Obviously, at some point, his electronic devices have been looked through by detectives, and some concerning material was found. He was, charged and had an unrelated, you know, his own court case for that. He was questioned by Singh's barristers in the first trial about the nature of the material that he was sharing online. We heard evidence about him having accessed murder porn online. And there was a question put to him, "Did you post anything about Toy accordingly on that website?" And he said no.
Mm. Chris, as well as kind of the placement of Tyson in that trial, the first trial, something else that was kind of dramatically different, not in substance, but in kind of appearance, I guess, was Sukhdeep Kaur. And this is Rajwinder Singh's wife. We heard in this trial that, you know, the first time that Sukhdeep Kaur saw Rajwinder Singh after he left the house the day after Toya Cordingley's murder was in court. And so this would have been, in the first trial, the first time that Sukhdeep Kaur saw Rajwinder Singh since that day. And, you know, she behaved very differently in that trial to this trial, right?
She did. Look, her evidence was pretty much the same, you know, allowing for slightly different questions being asked, but we heard more or less the same evidence from Sukhdeep Kaur. Now, she arrived at court kind of with a lot of police shielding her. This is a big trial. There are a lot of news cameras out the front of the courthouse. There's a lot of media attention. Understandably, for a lot of witnesses, that's very stressful. And Sukhdeep Kaur was one of them. Police giving her that kind of sense of protection. So they've actually escorted her into the court building with people guarding her and kind of covering her face to give. She was very reluctant to be caught on camera. And then in the courtroom, she goes into the witness box, and Rajwinder Singh's in the dock. Kind of there's only a few metres apart between dock and witness box in the Cairns courtroom, and a direct line of sight. She had a kind of veil over her face, and clearly didn't want to have kind of direct physical sight line to Rajwinder Singh. She was quite hard to hear. Remember, she was giving evidence through a Punjabi interpreter, so her answers were clear, but her physical voice wasn't always. After a couple of questions, Justice James Henry, who was presiding over that first trial, kind of said to her, look, you know, you can keep the head covering, but the jury needs to at least be able to see her face. She was kind of shielding herself so much. Come the second trial, again, she's not keen to be photographed or filmed as she's arriving. She's got that police kind of guard around her. But when she gets into the courtroom, it's just almost a completely different persona from Sukhdeep Kaur. For a start, she's not wearing the veil. Her face is in full view of everyone. I didn't see any direct kind of eye contact between Singh and Sukhdeep Kaur, but she was looking at him and he would look away. And then when she was looking away, he would sort of turn back towards her. But she spoke loudly, you know, we could hear what she was saying. Again, it was translated, but we could hear the Punjabi answers. And she did break down into tears again, kind of at the same point where the examination's veering into her marriage troubles. But then she pauses and she composes herself and says sorry in English. And she did answer in English a couple of times and just appeared to be a far more composed and confident person.
How did the defence characterise Rajwinder Singh between the two trials? In the second trial from Greg Maguire, we heard that he was, you know, a calm and peaceful nurse. Was that the same angle that they took in the first trial?
It was probably one of the more notable differences. I think in the first trial, you know, Angus Edwards really portrayed Rajwinder Singh as a flawed man. You know, he openly said, look, this man, he's not a killer, but he is a coward. You know, he used the line in one address to the jury, look, he wouldn't be the first deadbeat dad to go out for a pint of milk and not come back. Really what they were getting at there was he wasn't a killer. He was afraid. He saw what he saw on the beach and he ran away. It wasn't the right thing to do, but, you know, putting to the jury that there's an understandable reason he would do it, you know, really portraying this marriage as an unhappy one that he was just desperate to get out of. A bit less of that from Greg Maguire. Greg Maguire really made the point to the jury, you know, why would this man kill a woman on the beach? You know, he's a nurse. We've heard evidence that no one's known him to be violent. He's a peacenik, you know. We heard a lot of references to him being a vegetarian and a teetotaler. As though a vegetarian or a teetotaler couldn't be capable of a violent act. And that was really the difference in how Rajwinder Singh was characterised. It was almost put to the jury in the second trial that it would just be unfathomable for someone like him to do such a thing, a softly spoken, placid man. And again, it's against that backdrop that the defence case in the second trial was really just about all of these violent men with, you know, drug problems or mental health issues who were known to frequent Wangetti Beach.
I'm interested in some of the changes in the prosecution case as well, because, I mean, they've basically had a kind of trial run for this whole thing, right? They get one go at it, they see kind of how the defence is going to work, and then they come back and have another crack at securing a conviction against Rajwinder Singh. Chris, we've spoken a bit about this, and it sounds like it was, you know, basically the same sort of evidence, but just more of it.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most significant difference in the Crown case. We saw things like phone records for Evan McRae and Remy Fry in the first trial, kind of the Crown saying these people could not have killed Toy accordingly because they weren't physically there. We saw, you know, about 4 to 6 weeks worth of messages between Marco Hardenreich and Toya in the first trial. Again, the point was made, it's a boring relationship. They're just talking about really mundane things. There's nothing to see here. There's no violence, no coercion. The Crown just amped that right up to 11 in the second trial. Instead of a few weeks of messages between Toya and Marco, they've given us almost a whole year on both text and Facebook Messenger, just to really ram home the point. You're looking at the messages that on a good half of their relationship, there's just nothing there. The point was kind of laboured. Evan McRae and Remy Fry's phone records were obtained very early on in the investigation before police knew who Rajwinder Singh even was. I guess they've really seen how the defence characterised the police investigation in the first trial. They can have a look at you know, possible flaws in the way things were presented, you know, possible gaps that the jury was directed to, and they can cover those gaps. And I guess it's the kind of thing that in a normal normal proceeding, the defence gets to test prosecution evidence at a committal hearing, right? And they get to kind of cross-examine a witness without a jury, you know, a few months before a trial, just to kind of pick at chinks in the armour. And the Crown doesn't normally get to do that to a defence, but in the event of a hung jury, I guess they can. We did see evidence of a little bit of homework. Marco Heidenreich's alibi photos, for example, those photos that Joel Kumen, his friend, took while they were hiking at Spring Creek Falls, while Toy accordingly was being killed. We heard the same evidence in the first trial from the same police digital forensics expert that he's looked at this, he spent a lot of time on it, no evidence of manipulation. Yeah. But we heard evidence in the second trial that after March, he was asked to go back to that phone and do even more work and produce a report.
Yeah. Chris, knowing this was a retrial, I was listening really closely in the kind of the Crown openings and closing to see if they were, you know, what they were trying to close off, what they were trying to rule out. And it felt like Nathan Crane really had learnt, or at least the prosecution had at least probably done a fair bit of homework in between the two, because the way that he was trying to cover off on, you know, the other people on the beach, all of that, in both the opening and the closing, and Marco Heidenreich seemed particularly kind of pointed, very deliberate.
That's right. And again, just to really make the Crown case clear to the jury, at the end of the second trial, in his closing address, Crown Prosecutor Nathan Crane has put up on a screen in front of the courtroom, I guess, a list of 10 points, like the 10 key points that the Crown relies on to establish guilt beyond reasonable doubt in this case. There was a little bit of, confusion in the first trial. The deliberations went for more than 3 days of court time, and we got a lot of jury notes in that time. We didn't get any jury notes in the 7 hours of deliberations in the second trial. So quite a lot of questions being asked of the jury after they'd started deliberating in the first trial. And one request was actually to get copies of both the closing addresses from the defence and prosecution. And the judge kind of said, well, look, they have one chance to leave their impression on you, and you don't get transcripts of that because that's not evidence. They get to look over transcripts of evidence, but not transcripts of the closing addresses. So I think, again, just the Crown really taking care to make sure that everything was 100% clear, because there was so much detail, so much voluminous evidence, from the DNA to the phone tower data to the traffic camera footage. They just really put the effort in to make sure that there was kind of a concise narrative around it.
Chris, I want to jump into another question that's been sent to the case of at abc.net.au. This one's from Karen. Karen writes, "Hi, and thanks for another insightful podcast. The information that this is a retrial has brought up so many questions for me. If this case was in the minds of the people in the area, wouldn't there be a great awareness of the outcome of the first trial? Wouldn't this make it hard to find jurors with no prior knowledge?"
Well, something we couldn't tell you about at the time of the impaneling was that we heard about this larger than usual jury pool, but they were actually given a questionnaire to fill out in the jury room. So before they were even brought into court to have their numbers drawn, they were given a list of questions. I don't have the exact wording of the questions, but the flavour of it was essentially things to ascertain whether jurors could be impartial. And they did this for the first trial as well, asking prospective jurors about, did you ever display a Toya bumper sticker? Are you a member of any social media groups? Do you have any other reason kind of that would make you prejudiced in this case? And I guess part of that, as it is for all trials, is jurors are given that list of witnesses. Remember the 500 names that they were shown after they were selected? Kind of, do you know any of these people? They're asked again, is there any reason you have concern about sitting in on this case? So I think knowing about the Toy Accordingly murder is not automatically a point to exclude you from sitting on the jury pool. And look, by the end of the second trial, I guess a bit of pretense was done away with, and Greg Maguire is addressing the jury, and he's saying things to them along the lines of, you know, admit it, you saw this guy was brought back. It was very high profile, brought back from India. You probably thought he was guilty then, and I don't blame you for it, but you need to remember that he's now an innocent man in the dock until proven guilty.
Yeah. Karen's question continues on a little bit. Karen also asks, also, was there a reason that you didn't cover the original trial? And if you did cover a trial that resulted in a hung jury, would that make it even more difficult to find jury members for a second trial? They're ones I can answer, which is nice. So thank you for thinking of me, Karen. We didn't cover the original trial because the case of in this form didn't exist. It was Mushroom Case Daily at the time. We were covering the trial of Aaron Patterson. And so, yeah, it wasn't something that we could find our way into at the time. And if we did cover a trial that resulted in a hung jury, I mean, we're only ever presenting what jurors are hearing on the pod anyway. So hopefully that's not going to be an issue in any future trial that would happen after something we've covered resulting in a hung jury. And also jurors would be reminded not to listen to anything during a trial as well. We had a couple of questions about, you know, if we did that, would episodes need to be taken down and things like that? And that'd be a question for the court, if they could stay up, if we'd be made to take them down. We obviously would think that they should probably stay up because we'd only presented what had been presented in court. Chris, another question here, just on the outcome. We've talked a lot of kind of about this and around the outside of it, but I want to kind of nail it down with this question from Ruby. Ruby writes, "Hi, Stocky and Chris. Love the podcast. First time submitting a question. I can't help but wonder what changed with the evidence between the two trials, first with a hung jury and second with a rapid conviction. Did something change in how the cases or evidence was presented, or is this just the variance, in inverted commas, due to picking different sets of jurors?"
It's kind of one of those crystal ball things because we don't know what goes on in the jury room. Your jurors aren't allowed to reveal anything about their deliberations during or any time after a trial. So those jurors who deliberated in the first trial are never allowed to tell anyone else about what actually went down. They're not even allowed to tell the judge voting numbers. So all we know is that they weren't able to reach a unanimous verdict. And in fact, quite early on in the deliberations in that first trial, after a matter of hours, they sent a note to the judge essentially saying we're stuck. But we don't know what the numbers were. You know, it could be 11 to 1, it could be 6 to 6. There's just no way of knowing. So that's an element of the question I really can't answer. And I think that the second part really comes down to what I've been talking about the Crown kind of looking at the first trial and presenting their evidence in a slightly different way in some areas with a little bit of greater detail, even maybe putting in a bit more thought into what time of the day certain witnesses were giving evidence. You know, there was that day that the jury went to Wongeti Beach and they did that 4-kilometre walk in the sun. Court didn't reconvene in the afternoon after that, but the Crown was going to call, I guess, a bunch of witnesses who were less critical to their case, you know, those people who'd been to the beach that day and hadn't really seen anything conclusive. So there was a lot of thought into kind of presenting really critical evidence and maybe the harder to understand evidence or the more detailed evidence around things like DNA while the jury is actually fresh, and less so when it's 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon and they're tired from several hours of deliberations. Mm. And they have that natural advantage of having been able to, review their own performance, I guess. And remember as well, the defence, Greg Maguire, KC, would have had to review the first trial himself, and he would have probably known that the prosecution was going to cover off on some of their weaker points, which is probably why he has kind of shifted to making some different arguments. You know, at one point he introduced this guy, Joshua James Richards, who was a man who murdered someone at Mossman on the 17th of October, so just 4 days before Toy accordingly was killed, and he wasn't arrested until 3 days after her death. And, you know, he kind of introduced this guy as, well, he's a murderer in the area who was at large on that day. Joshua James Richards didn't come up at all in the first trial. Name wasn't even mentioned. So as much as the prosecution is able to kind of review their performance, it does give the defence kind of that impetus to kind of widen their scope and try and, you know, introduce some new variables that the first trial never heard.
Yeah, and I mean, as well, Chris, we saw a juror removed during this trial for concerns over their impartiality. And we talked about that in one of our episodes this week as well. And I mean, if we didn't see that happening throughout the trial, could be looking at a different outcome, could be looking at deliberations that go for so much longer. So, yeah, again, we have no idea kind of what is discussed and unpacked in that room. Chris, I'm really looking forward to hearing kind of what you think, what you thought of the verdict, if you were surprised by it. But I'll save that for our What We Really Think episode that we'll have out on Tuesday next week. Is there anything else that you're keen to unpack and for us to talk about in that episode?
Yeah, Stocky, look, I'm looking forward to, I guess, delving a bit behind a lot of the crime element of what happened. And, you know, we can talk a bit more about Toye Cordingley as a person. You know, we've discussed during this trial about how the nature of evidence doesn't really allow you to do that while the trial is running. But, you know, it's important to remember as well that there is a person, you know, and a very loved person behind this horrendous crime. And, you know, she's remembered by loved ones for other reasons, you know, and there was a lot of hugging and a lot of tears after the verdict and after the sentencing was handed down. So you can really see how much she means to a lot of people, not just in the courtroom, but across the broader community of Cairns as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, keen to talk a bit more about Toye Cordingley in that episode on Tuesday next week when we talk about what we really think about the trial of Rajwinder Singh this time around, guilty of murdering Toye Cordingley. Also, we have been getting your emails about the very big news in Victoria today. You might have heard that former Jetstar pilot Greg Lynn has been acquitted for the murder of missing camper Carol Clay, and a retrial has been ordered there. Now, we don't have the judge's reason for this decision yet, but it's something we're aware of and be keeping tabs on. So make sure you're following the case of on the ABC Listen app, wherever else you get your podcast, so you're front of the queue for that one. The Case of Toye's Murder is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Chris Tester and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller, and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, to the Queensland Newsroom, and to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on land of the Gimoy, Wallabara Yidinji, and Wurundjeri people.